ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Sound familiar? There can sometimes be...
No.
When it comes to bedtime.
No.
Or nap time.
No.
Or dinner time.
No.
Look, any time.
No.
Drown out the sound of your progeny's complaints with nature. Specifically with Nature Sounds by Ann Jones. Some long recordings that I've made around the country. Just nature. No wobblies.
No.
And for free.
Yay!
Wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. As H5N1 bird flu looms, there are a few key groups on the front lines: scientists, infectious disease experts, and volunteer wildlife carers. With hundreds of confirmed cases across five states and authorities warning the virus could spill over into other mammals and humans, are these volunteers primed to get the support they need to protect themselves as they protect our wildlife? Also ahead, does Australia need a minister for toilets? It's a fact of life. Everybody poops. And in this Game of Thrones, knowing your next move is crucial. How do we make public toilets truly accessible for everyone who needs them? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, having a beachfront home used to be the ultimate Aussie aspiration. You can wake up, walk through your backyard and straight into the ocean. But extreme weather events are eroding our iconic coastline and eroding that dream for many too. Over $25 billion worth of coastal property is at substantial risk from inundation and erosion due to extreme weather. And last week, the New South Wales Land and Environment Court ruled in favour of beachfront homeowners on the Central Coast who want to build a seawall to protect their homes from erosion. But some experts are warning we can't sandbag or seawall our way out of this. The only permanent solution is to leave. So as the effects of climate change arrive quite literally at our doorstep, what do we protect? Private property? Public access? The environment? You're about to hear what options are available to us, but tell me, where's your favourite coastal spot and what changes have you seen to it over the past few years? And here with me is Ken Haley. Ken lives on Phillip Island in Victoria, which is under threat from coastal erosion. He's the chair of a local foreshore action group. Ken, welcome to Life Matters.
Oh, thank you, Tegan, and hello to all your listeners.
So Ken, you live at a place called Silverleaves. Tell me about this community.
Well, Tegan, Silverleaves is on Phillip Island, which is internationally known for its fairy penguins, obviously, and it's really a nature reserve, the whole island. It's a permanent population of about 15,000, and I live in the northern beaches, northeast, which is a sand beach of about 2.5 kilometres near Cowes, which is the main town, and we have been facing erosion problems, pretty bad ones, since about 2013 when we formed our group. However, we have a history on the island of erosion, and from the 1950s, the local residents built seawalls and groins right the way along this 2.5 kilometre section of coastline to protect their assets.
How has the erosion sort of affected, like, your property prices and your ability to live in this community?
Well, that's actually quite interesting because, you know, we're living the experience of coastal erosion down here in Silverleaves. We've had two examples in the last 5 years of sea level getting to the actual boundaries of properties. Mm. The human cost is absolutely terrible to see. We've had people who have had mental health issues. Some people have actually got physically ill. I know of two residents that had to leave and stay with relatives in Melbourne because they couldn't sleep at night hearing the water and the wind. Mm. We're a north-facing beach with a 3-metre tidal range, so we do get pounded by the northerlies very much. And we're about the only north-facing beach in Victoria, funnily enough. So we cop a lot. And basically, we gradually have been working with, over the years, with all different levels of government, with various departments, the Department of Environment and Melbourne Water, and we just feel isolated and alone and unloved. And people talk about retreat, and I'm not a climate skeptic at all. In fact, we may all have to retreat in the end. But in the interim, with no state or national framework, no one knows what to do.
Mm.
People talk about retreat, but you speak to residents, and that's all they do. They talk about retreat, and there's no plan, there's no action plan. All there is consultants and talk, basically.
That's a really interesting thing you mentioned there, Ken, about retreat, because I want to talk about that soon. But first, Anne-Marie Kreller is also with us. She's a climate social scientist, a researcher at the University of Wollongong, looking at environmental threats to coastal communities. Anne-Marie, listening to Ken's story there, how familiar is that to you?
Very familiar to me. Hearing the psychosocial impacts on the community about feeling abandoned, about feeling sick, about being fearful, and about being fearful of the ocean and the lack of national and local planning framework, okay, for not just coastal protection, but what do we mean when we talk about retreat, if that's the possibility? Very familiar to me. It reminds me of one of two cases that I was working with when I completed my PhD at the University of New South Wales in the Central Coast, that has been debating coastal erosion and what to do about it for up to 50 years.
What happened in that case?
Well, there's two cases, one being at North Entrance. I didn't explore that case in my PhD, but I did explore the case at Wombril Beach, which is just about a little bit northeast of the Central Coast Business District. And like a lot of other coastal areas in New South Wales, it really cops quite violent storms, east coast lows, around mid-year. And it's these storms have been hitting that area since 1974, 1978. Most recent ones were 2016, 2020, when the power of the ocean was so evident to me, because the cracks that were in housing foundations just failed and some of the houses started literally sliding into the ocean. And there's been a debate in that area about preserving private property or the beach for such a long time. And it's an incredibly contentious and emotional issue for people, because it's like an either-or situation, a trade-off between, what do we protect? Do we protect private property? Do we protect public beaches? What are the trade-offs here? Who pays for not just the seawalls, but the nourishment of the beach, which is a consequence of building seawalls, whether that's private or publicly funded? It's an incredibly difficult issue. There's no single easy solutions.
Mm. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor speaking with Anne-Marie Kreller, so a climate social scientist and researcher at the University of Wollongong, and Ken Haley, who's the chair of Cowes East Foreshore Preventative Action Group. We're talking about coastal erosion and the kind of push and pull between wanting to protect private properties on our coastline and waterfront areas around Australia, and how that intersects with public access and the environmental needs there. I'd love to know where your favourite coastal spot is and maybe how you've seen it change over the past few years. Well, Scott says the coastline is a dynamic environment. It's not tenable for the public to be expected to pay for protection of private property. Ownership of these properties is a personal risk, a risk that needs to be the burden of owners who gambled. Similarly, another person says, if you buy near the coast, you take the risk surely. Anne-Marie, should the risk fall only to the property owner?
Can I just Well, just briefly respond to the comments is that, yes, I do hear that. I see that comment a lot. And I also see it because I follow some of these cases on social media, and there is always that response. And I recognise that I've also heard that response as well from people that I've interviewed. It's a valid one. We're raising debates here that need to be addressed. It's you're right. Coastal areas are dynamic, and a lot of the time people are given this information when they buy a property. So there is that real sense of the risk being borne by the property buyer. That's why these notifications on property titles exist. In New South Wales, they're called 149Cs. I don't know what they're called in Victoria. But also in saying that, climate change does change these coastal areas. So then the risk starts to be experienced in new areas. And how then do we address that when people are buying into an area where there may not have been a risk and there is one now? So that also impacts low-lying areas on the foreshore as well, rather than coastal erosion. You talked about inundation before. Previously, some of these inundated areas and flooded areas in New South Wales may not have experienced flooding previously.
Yeah, so comparing it to previous risk is tricky. Well, also here with us is Professor Tim Smith, Deputy Vice Chancellor Research at Southern Cross University. Tim has spent 25 years working on coastal issues around the world. He's recently published a paper looking at how these issues are being dealt with internationally. Tim, welcome.
Oh, hi, Tegan. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me a bit about this recent court ruling in New South Wales that's allowing people to protect their own properties?
Oh, it's a really interesting case. I mean, it really, some of the decision really goes against the heart of the Coastal Protection Act. But I think it just highlights really that our legal system is really struggling to keep pace with these coastal property disputes. We really refer to these sorts of issues as wicked problems. They're highly complex, but with very high decision stakes. So essentially what we did was we wanted to see if there are examples in other parts of the world, other sorts of legal jurisdictions, to see whether they were handling them any differently. So we looked at a range of traditions, both the common law system we have here, civil law system like in Brazil, religious law systems, centralised systems and so on. But really the story was really quite the same throughout the world. It was really a predominance of prioritising private property interests over public or environmental interests.
So, I mean, Anne-Marie used the phrasing before, this sort of either or, public or private interests. Does it have to be a dichotomy?
Well, there's a number of strategies that are being used, like nature-based solutions, for instance, that are trying to protect parts of the coast while providing environmental habitat and beach access. But, you know, at the end of the day, we know what is likely for different parts of our coast line. We know that over time, the protection works that we put in place in some areas won't necessarily be feasible into the longer term. And we will certainly need to look at different sorts of decision pathways. I think the real challenge, though, is identifying when you transition from one adaptation option to another, like retreat, for instance.
So, yeah, you argue that there's a tipping point where we have to consider walking away from these locations. What does that look like?
Look, I think this is very context specific. And as we know, and we've heard from Ken, you know, it plays out quite differently in different parts of the country. So I don't think it's a blanket approach that we need, but certainly we need clear guidance, I think, in terms of a national and state and national approaches to these sorts of things. But certainly, I mean, if you're seeing, a property that's unfit to live in, I mean, certainly it's obvious that there will need to be some sort of action taken.
So, Ken, talking about this idea of managed retreat, it's being talked about as a necessary part of future planning. How do you feel about that prospect?
Well, I sort of class myself as not a climate sceptic at all, as a climate adapter. And I think the Silverleaves experience here, which is ongoing, by the way, I feel that until we get to that tipping point, we've got to have plans in place to adapt to what the climate throws at us. And humans have always adapted to everything that's thrown at us, be it COVID, whatever. And I think too early, people are now voicing the R word, and it's used a lot in our community by politicians, councils. But no one then says, how does this work? We've got 600 properties in Silverlees. A lot of them were built in the 50s, 60s and so on. Climate change wasn't mentioned then. So they're not Johnny-come-lately millionaires living, building McMansions on the coast. They're people that live there and have lived there for decades. I'm an example of that. And suddenly you're getting told by consultants, because the Department of Environment has sacked all their coastal experts and they now exclusively rely on consultants to tell them what they think. And basically, we just say to them, what does retreat mean? And no one knows. Does it mean compulsory acquisition? How do you give compensation to 600 homes? Because if you say you organise a retreat, the properties immediately are valueless. How do you set a value on those properties? Because some are old, some are newer, et cetera. And basically, where do we move to? And how do you remove 600 homes? Asbestos-ridden. You've also got to remove the sewerage, the drainage, the roads, the electricity, and so on. It's a massive undertaking. And when you speak to politicians about it, and we have some good politicians in our area, they all just shrug their shoulders because it is such a big issue that no government is prepared to look at it seriously.
It's so complex. There's so many moving parts, as you say. Anne-Marie, what does retreat look like when it's done well?
I want to circle back to, something Tim said, and he's 100% right. This is a really wicked problem. It's the sea level rise and adaptation and retreat and all the actions are legal, technical, social, cultural, et cetera, and private property is often upheld in, land and environment courts and whatnot. And I often do feel like I'm at the interface between communities and planners. I actually, for my PhD and one of my most recent publications and for an article in The Conversation, wrote about a community that I also spoke to in the Central Coast. It's very different geographically. It's more of a low-lying area. And there was a real resistance to having a conversation about the R word. But there were also, in my cohort and the people I spoke to, a really quite strong environmental and climate voice, because there's a very, active climate and environmental movement up in the Central Coast, and they wanted to have that conversation. They recognised retreat was not something we had to think about right now, but if we didn't have that conversation about what it looked like, things would get worse down the track. We're just kicking the can down the road. So importantly, these people identified retreat is going to be this inherently conflicted emotional issue, and there was a real sense of solidarity around how much this place and this location mattered to everyone. And it was important to really identify that sense of belonging and wanting to keep that community cohesion together. And I know it might sound like wishy-washy statements I'm making here, but quite often this psychosocial process is absent from the planning instruments. And like I said, I'm a social scientist, so I don't deal a lot with the legal issues. But everyone I spoke to tended to come out with that as acknowledging the human factors. And I spoke to people on both sides of the fence, both for and against planned retreat. It was almost polarized.
You are listening.
In a way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Whenever you're dealing with humans, it gets complicated. It is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Anne-Marie Kreller, social scientist and researcher at the University of Wollongong, Ken Haley from the Cowes East Foreshore Preventative Action Group, and Professor Tim Smith, Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research at Southern Cross University, talking about coastal erosion, its effects on communities, and who pays, and what kind of interventions do we do when, especially private properties, become at risk of coastal erosion. You're sharing so much with me on the text line today. You're sharing about the beaches that you love that are changing. Kieran says Moffat Beach in Queensland, lovely beach now destroyed by massive stone rock wall. Over-engineered maybe. Necessary? Sadly, yes. Must have cost millions. Another, Mary says coastal erosion doesn't only affect high value properties, and many people have owned them for decades before climate change created new risks. In southwest Victoria, a lot of these areas are low-cost housing and also farming land. I don't think landholders should wear the cost of sea level rise. At the same time, they should not be allowed to build seawalls and remove access to the beach. They're only ever temporary anyway. Coastal retreat is inevitable. There's something in Mary's text I want to pick up with you, Anne-Marie. This idea that coastal retreat means people are moving somewhere else. What does that do for the neighbouring communities behind these beachfront properties?
Yeah, one of the concepts I came across in a paper recently was about climate gentrification, and it's when displaced communities living in low-lying areas then have to move somewhere else, and the people that are living on higher ground that, you know, maybe their land is worth less, are getting displaced by people moving elsewhere and, you know, moving up and displacing them, if that makes sense. Like, this is something that came up in the academic literature in Miami, where people living in wealthier areas were displacing poorer or lower income communities in higher areas.
So, Tim, Anne-Marie, we're getting a little short on time. Tim, I'm really interested to know what a national approach could look like here.
Well, I think it's been really interesting listening to the conversation, because it's been so dominant towards private property. But I think we also need to remember that, you know, these coastal assets are a huge part of Australian psyche in terms of being a coastal nation. You know, public access to these areas, public enjoyment of these areas, as well as the environmental benefits they provide in terms of migratory birds and so on. You know, I think we need to think about this very holistically. We need to really take a systems approach to how we look at this issue. So, you know, I really do think that, you know, we need to think about how all of these values can work together and what we are going to prioritise. I don't think we've come to a consensus on that. It certainly hasn't been reflected in any sorts of state or national legislation or policy. But we certainly, as Ken said, you know, there needs to be some sort of certainty. There needs to be guidelines around what we're going to be doing moving forward and what that transition strategy is going to look like.
So, Ken, how do you feel about your future on Phillip Island?
Well, it's interesting. Parts of Phillip Island, of course, are up on cliffs, and we're on the sandy part of the island. One of the things that the human costs of this, now Silverlees has been designated a land subject to inundation, has an overlay. All the insurance companies, for example, now list in your policy you're not covered by inundation by sea. So when the water gets to the property lines, people know they have no cover for their property. We spoke to the Department of Environment about this and said, what happens when the water gets to the properties? The answer was, ring the SES. I mean, people are frightened, and frightened turns to anger. Some of our residents are retirees. Property prices have crashed. The land values are nil and have just been revalued. If they want to move to retirement facilities, they can't sell their homes. Mm-hmm. Always, it's the small people that get crushed in these things.
A wicked problem, like Tim said. I'm so sorry, Ken. We're fresh out of time, but thank you all so much for joining me today. Ken Haley, Chair of Cowes East Foreshore Preventive Action Group, a resident of Silver Leaves on Phillip Island, Professor Tim Smith, Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research at Southern Cross University, and Anne-Marie Kreller, Climate Social Scientist and Researcher at the University of Wollongong. And thank you for your texts as well. Really interesting, Ken mentioned insurance right at the end there. One says, people often complain about strict and complex local planning rules, but coastal erosion and similar hazards are exactly why we need planning laws. It's not the individual property owner's responsibility. If the council allows you to build in a location, then there is a responsibility for that council to provide guardrails and the responsibility of the owner to abide by the guardrails. Insurance is a whole other issue. Well, it is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, as H5 bird flu cases increase, it's volunteers on the front lines spotting and reporting sick birds. Are they supported enough for this type of outbreak? When there is a fire out in the country, the Rural Fire Service swoops in. When a flood hits, hundreds turn up as the SES. When crowds flock to the beach for summer, the surf lifesavers are out in force. And when wildlife is injured, there are hundreds of volunteer organisations across the country to step up and save these animals. These volunteers are now on the front line of monitoring and responding to the impending threat of H5 bird flu. This isn't your average sick bird. Finding an infected animal is high stakes. Seeing a dead or dying animal is never an easy thing to manage. So with the first mass mortality of Australian wildlife taking place, there's 220 cases confirmed, how are volunteers being supported in their efforts to protect wildlife? Well, you're about to hear from a wildlife carer and from a researcher in this space. I'd love to hear from you as well. Are you involved in a wildlife protection group? What are you being told about bird flu? How are you preparing? And with me is Matt Watson, President of WA Seabird Rescue. Matt, welcome to Life Matters.
Yeah, thanks, Tegan. Nice to be here.
So WA was the first state to see the H5 bird flu. When you found out, what was going through your mind?
So this happened back in June, and I was, as it happens, working overseas, which made things a bit difficult. And that's the reality of kind of juggling this volunteer role with work commitments. But I guess the initial feeling was a sense of relief, almost. We've been preparing for this situation, this inevitability, perhaps, for years. We've seen bird flu spread through the other continents, including Antarctica. And there was an expectation of when this will get here, what will happen. So it's an intense and perhaps unprecedented time, but there was initially that sense of relief, especially because of volunteers that picked up this bird, followed the right process, followed the right protocol, and in doing so protected themselves and kind of safeguarded that kind of the welfare of the bird at the same time.
You're mentioning process and protocol there, so you're obviously informing and training your volunteers in preparation for this.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, there's a very low risk of transmission to humans. We've seen that around the world. And it's a risk as president of Seabird Rescue that I really have to mitigate. It's in our best interest to make sure that our volunteers are aware of that risk. And that's not just with bird flu. That's you're dealing with injured and frightened animals. These birds can lash out, regardless of the situation for rescue, and we make sure that our volunteers have the right PPE to protect themselves and to make sure that transmission risk is minimised.
How are the volunteers feeling about it? Are they stressed about it?
I wouldn't say stressed. We've got a great bunch of volunteers in WA. We've got over 100 volunteers around the coastline. There's lots of questions, and I have questions too. The reality is we're falling in line with a government-led process, and there's been a few gaps in kind of conversations around what our expected role is. We've been rescuing seabirds for over 23 years in Western Australia. We're very well equipped. We have a good network in the right places. Yet we were just a bit unsure on what our role was as we kind of navigated this with the state government and the national response. But that's got better over time. The volunteers are volunteers. They can choose not to engage in higher risk rescues. But I think trepidation, but certainly a desire to seek more clarity about what our official role is as we get responding to local transmission as it happens in WA.
Well, also here with us is Christopher Lawson, a research fellow in marine ecology at the University of Queensland. Christopher, what role do volunteers play in this conservation space?
Hey, thanks for having me. A lot, right? They do a lot of different roles. But at the end of the day, they are volunteers. And as we just heard, they don't have to do these things, right? It is a choice. And so one of the biggest things that they can do is surveillance, right? Because but my core philosophy around this is that we need to match the ask of volunteers with the capacity of what they can actually do. They're not a replacement for professional scientists or government biosecurity officers, but they can provide things that those groups can't, right? And that's generally scale, right? We can have hundreds of volunteers distributed all over the place. And if we could match the ask, so, hey, can you take a photo, call this phone number, then we kind of have this distributed workforce, this army of people who can do all this work, but we'd have to support them in the right ways to be able to do that.
I'm just thinking about how huge Australia's coastline is, the sort of remote areas where an injured or sick seabird might turn up. Like, volunteers are sort of non-negotiable. You can't have a scientist on every rock around Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I mostly work on the Great Barrier Reef. I don't really work on birds. So I'm not involved in the bird flu response. But on the Great Barrier Reef, for example, that is an area the size of Italy or Japan. And we have the world's biggest coral reef monitoring program in Australia, but it still only gets to maybe 5% of the Great Barrier Reef. And so we developed a citizen science project called the Great Reef Census, which goes out and uses volunteers to sort of fill in all those gaps. And it's, again, it's not a replacement for the professionals. It sort of complements it. But we can't, it's you're right, it's just too big, right? You can't pay people to do all this.
You are listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Christopher Lawson, a research fellow in marine ecology at the University of Queensland, and Matt Watson, president of the WA Seabird Rescue Volunteer Organisation. If you're a wildlife volunteer, I'd really love to know how you're feeling about bird flu, if you feel like you've been informed, and I wonder what makes you be a volunteer. Matt, you sort of gestured before to the amount of preparation your organisation had from government. What was most useful to you in terms of feeling prepared and informed?
I believe it was access to veterinary support. We are rescue volunteers. We don't necessarily have veterinary skills in our network, but the government leveraged that portal for us. So we were able to speak to veterinary surgeons and vet nurses, and they gave us some really good information on how to don and doff PPE, how to basically manage the risk for our volunteers. It was fantastic to have that connection made. That was, yeah, without it, we'd have been knocking on doors and exploring alternate pathways to get that knowledge. It's really good to have that. And like Chris said, being able to kind of work with marine rangers and other kind of state officials to kind of help amplify our network. Ultimately, we are the ones that quite often train state government officials on how to handle birds. This is a two-way transfer of knowledge, which we've been very thankful for.
Christopher, can you give us a bit of a refresher on why H5 bird flu is different to other illnesses we've seen before?
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I'm not avian immunologist, but it's again, I mean, the mortality rate is phenomenal, right? I mean, the contagiousness of it is phenomenal. You know, as I'm sure you know from COVID, when you get these combinations of things that are you know, very contagious and very deadly, like it's, you know, it's not great. And I guess the issue with Australian wildlife is that there's been so many stresses up to this point. And so, you know, there's climate change, land clearing, ocean warming, invasive species, now deadly bird flu. Any one of these things our wildlife populations probably could have handled. But when you string them all together, just consecutive one after the other, there's not enough time to recover in between these threats. And then that's when you just see sort of these, you know, extinction level kind of events.
And it's not just birds that bird flu is likely to affect, Christopher.
Yeah, absolutely. So the government released their sort of list of, you know, which they've had for a while, of the species and their threat levels, you know, extreme, very high, their sort of susceptibility to this virus. And it's not just birds, it's a lot of marine mammals. You can go look at it. It's public. It's quite depressing reading. orcas are on there, which like, there's all these things that you think, oh, wow, this is actually very far-stretched. And then you look at the population sizes of some of these groups and it's, you know, if you add something, 75% mortality to a group that is already threatened, it's quite depressing, to be honest.
Matt, what are you expecting to see over the next few months?
A big strain on the volunteer community if this goes to scale, which we're seeing in South Australia and Victoria. Mass mortalities, a response of euthanize to manage the spread. These are people that are very in tune with wildlife and our environment and will respect that need to euthanize birds at scale. And that's not our job to do that, but we'll work within that system to make sure that's the number one outcome. Seeing birds die and seeing wildlife under kind of stress is emotional for our volunteers. I suspect there'll be a pretty heavy toll with burnout for our volunteers. We see it already in a non-bird flu environment, but to kind of amplify that level of pressure and emotion by having mass deaths, mass euthanasia. Big concern from the public as they call our hotline saying, what can I do? And a sense of helplessness as we navigate this kind of world where the first concern would be bird flu and managing that spread. It's going to be a heavy toll on our volunteers.
Christopher, we had a bit of practice with COVID. Do you think that this outbreak is going to lead governments to rethink how we approach things?
I mean, I'd like to think so, but don't hold your breath. I mean, I think for me, the core issue is that we don't really appreciate the value of nature as a whole, as a society. It's, you know, 50% of our economy sort of moderately or heavily relies on nature in some way. This is like, you know, things like pollinators pollinating agricultural crops, otherwise they don't produce fruit. There is real sort of monetary value in ecosystem services that are of, you can put a dollar value on. And yet we struggle to get 1% of GDP to put into prepare for these things and preserve nature. And I think if it was any other sector was supporting 50% of our economy, it would be an absolute no-brainer that it would be 1% investment of our GDP to support that.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me. Matt Watson, President of WA Seabird Rescue, and Christopher Lawson, Research Fellow in Marine Ecology at the University of Queensland. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Coming up soon, what makes a great public toilet? If you have a favourite, I want to know what it is. But first, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull on the role of a lifetime, becoming a grandfather. From commanding the halls of power to playing hide and seek in the halls of his house, former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has a lot more time on his hands now to devote to his favourite activity, playing silly games with his grandchildren. In our series, The Grandparent Trap, we introduced you to a side of prominent Australians like grumpy grandpa Bruce Pascoe, actor Lynn McGranger, whose twin granddaughters are only a few weeks old. And here is what grandparenting has taught Malcolm Turnbull.
Hi, I'm Malcolm Turnbull. I'm former Prime Minister, but most importantly, grandfather to four grandchildren, two of whom call me Baba and the other two call me Yeye. I was called Baba by the first grandchild, Jack. The general tradition is that the first grandchild has naming rights over grandparents. The only problem with that is that our son's wife is Chinese and Baba in Chinese is dad. The Chinese word for the paternal grandfather is Yeye. So I am Yeye to my son's children and Baba to my daughter's children. I asked the grandkids what they thought I did. You know, they said, oh, you're always explaining things to us, you know, which was said in a positive way. But it's interesting, Jack, a few years ago, as the grandson, he did a painting for school, which was a picture of me paddling in my kayak. And he said, my Baba loves me and I love him. He is important to me because he explains things to me. And I like playing at the beach with him. You know, yesterday I was in the city with them, with Lucy, and us talking to our granddaughter about the history of some of the buildings in Martin Place, and we're talking about how, you know, they'd been banks of one kind or another, and going to some of the history, and they, you know, I don't know how much of that they soak up, but that's the sort of thing I bore my grandchildren with. But they, you know, they're very polite. They give every appearance of being interested. I asked Lucy whether my grandparenting style was different to my parenting style. And she said, well, the difference was that when the kids were young, you were very busy, you know, so really busy and travelling a lot and on the phone a lot. And of course, you know, since I stopped being Prime Minister, which is most of the grandchildren's life, because they were very little when I was Prime Minister, tiny, you know, I've now got a lot, I've got more time in my hands. I loved going on expeditions. But one thing we used to do, we've done a lot over the years, is take a little inflatable boat out to Shark Island, and that's always been good. We've done that for years and years, and just gone and scampered around the rocks and, you know, played pirates and all that stuff. And I did that with my own kids. And I mean, there's a lot of things, a lot of experiences that you have, particularly if you've lived in the same city all your life, as I have with Lucy, a lot of things you do with your grandchildren that you've done with your children. At least for me, my grandchildren make me feel younger. Not that I feel particularly old, but they do make me feel younger, because I'm doing things with a, you know, 10-year-old or a 9-year-old or an 8-year-old. The last time I was doing these things, I was 30 years younger, right? And so that's a sense you're repeating, you know, really beloved, important, touching parts of your past with another generation, with your grandchildren, and it does take you back to the generation before when you were doing those things with your own children. I really enjoy the company of my grandchildren. They're always interesting, and I don't have problems with them being badly behaved, to be quite honest. They're probably well behaved, and I think, you know, grandfathers have a little bit of an authority thing going on there that they sense, you know, and so they're a bit better behaved than they might otherwise be. You've got to have something going for you.
Former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, a.k.a. Baba, or Yeah Yeah to his grandkids, talking to me as part of our series, The Grandparent Trap. You can listen back to all of the installments of The Grandparent Trap now. Just search ABC Listen, The Grandparent Trap, or Life Matters. Coming up next, what makes a public dunny a royal flush? Public toilets. You probably don't think about them very much until you find yourself in desperate need of one. But when nature calls, it is always a relief to know there's a place nearby where you can take care of business. There are estimated to be around 23,000 public toilets across Australia. But you and I both know that not all loos are created equal. And it actually takes a fair bit of planning to design a dunny that works for everyone who needs it. So you're about to meet someone who is incredibly passionate about public toilets, so much so a few years back she went on a round-the-world research trip to find the leading examples of laboratories. So I want to add to her list. Tell me about your favourite public loo and what it means to you. And I will tell you my top toilets as well. But first, please meet Catherine Weber, international toilet enthusiast and social planning practitioner. She's been looking into how public toilets are critical to community participation. Catherine, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Tegan.
I want to know how much water and coffee and stuff you were drinking around the world so that you could, you know, use each toilet when you came to it.
Oh, look, there was lots of visits to look at the toilets. I didn't necessarily use every single one of them. That would have taken up way too much time.
Missed opportunity. So what got you interested in toilets in the first place, Catherine?
So as you mentioned, I have been a social planner, and so I've been looking at how people can participate in our public spaces, whether it's through programming, whether it's through design of our public spaces. And it was over many years that I realised I was collecting stories about public toilets, about whether they were, you know, they ended up being a key feature to whether or not people could stay in a space once they had arrived. So, you know, there might have been that, you know, they got there and it was all good and dandy until they need to go to the toilet, and then the toilet wasn't usable for them, so they had to leave. So it really meant that they were missing out on the activities and the places, out and about.
What kind of people were most sort of impacted by a lack of toilets?
Look, I think it's going to impact everyone across their life stage. So when you've got parents with small children, you're going to need to, you know, find a toilet often with short notice. When you're elderly, there's also, you can have, it's called a loo leash. So, you know, you don't have a long time to find a local toilet. People with disabilities, people who are menstruating, everyone needs to go to a toilet. And so we'll have, you know, have different timings when it's important that, you know, they need to go.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Catherine Weber, in capital letters, international toilet enthusiast. She's also a social planning practitioner and former Rodney Warmington Churchill Fellow. We're talking about public toilets. Yes, yes, it's very funny to talk about toilets. It's also super important, as Catherine's research looks into. It really has a lot to do with who gets to stay in public places and participate in community. Having a toilet nearby is critical. If you want to tell me about your favourite public loo, one says, a great public toilet is the one that is right there when you need it. Dean says public toilets need to be a single door open to a public area, with every toilet having a sink above the cistern. No needs for boys and girls loos, just like home, a loo for all. And Ali says, I really love the toilets at the National Portrait Gallery. Terrazzo floor, gorgeous finishing, not an afterthought. Rather, they have been wonderfully considered by the architect. I visit each time I go to Canberra, and I even took a selfie portrait there. Pants up, I promise. Tell me your top toilet on 0418 226 576. But Catherine, I'm interested, there's a couple of sort of features that people have called out in those texts. What are the features of a good public loo according to your research?
I would definitely agree with those texts. Location is key. You want them where you are and when you need it. Also, I do agree with the single stalls that open out into a public space. I think it means that everyone can use them. You can see what's happening. People can feel safer using them. You don't have to go around many corners and have lots of doors that you're opening and closing. So, yeah, location, easy to access. Having the hand wash in a toilet can be really helpful, particularly if people are using period products. So, you know, you can wash your hands without having to touch the doors and go out into a communal space. Then you got those other features, so that, you know, it is accessible. There's not stairs. It's wide enough. There's enough space to put your backpack or your handbag or the pram, whoever you're traveling with. Also, then you've got the cleanliness element. So, you know, often you'll get to a public toilet and you won't feel safe because, you know, it doesn't feel clean. So there's a whole variety of different features.
So one of the issues you also have mentioned is knowing where they are. Tell me about the National Public Toilet Map.
So Australia's really fortunate that we've got this National Public Toilet Map. And the stat you mentioned at the top of the show about 23,000 public toilets, that's how many we've got registered on the National Public Toilet Map. It's a website and an app on your phone. And so you can search for toilets, but then also search for features within those toilets. So if you need a right or a left-hand transfer, if you're using a wheelchair, if you need a gender-neutral toilet, if you need a baby change table, all of those are different features that you can search for on the map. So, you know, we're very fortunate in Australia. Not many places have a map like this that is dedicated specifically to public toilets.
Is every toilet there on the map, though?
Oh, look, we don't think so. It is an open source a map, so it does, you know, there is no one register of who owns all the toilets and where they are. So we are, every year there is called the Great Dunny Hunt, where people can add maps, add toilets to the map. So, yeah, we do think there's probably a lot more out there. So some of the maps, some of the toilets on the map could be ones that are in parks. They could also be in service stations or shopping centres. So there's a mixture of those, public toilets and also ones that might be in commercial spaces as well.
You're telling me your favourite public toilets on 0418 226 576. Lots and lots and lots of toilets being shouted out here. Philip says the central west town Dunny Do wanted to create Oz's biggest dunny. It created much division locally and was rejected, not hugely. Monica is shouting out Seoul and Japan's toilets, which are heated, seated, laced with music and wash you as well. Liz also is saying Japanese toilets often have a baby seat, so you don't have to hold young children. Liz, I saw a baby seat in a Singapore airport and it blew my mind. I was like, obviously a parent designed this. I thought it was genius. And another says Jock Kamini toilets near Bendigo, an architectural masterpiece. And I also wanted to mention Queenstown in New Zealand. They have the public toilets there that have rainforest music and you wave the hand to flush and dispense toilet paper. My daughter went to the toilet in Queenstown and came back and was like 11 out of 10 toilet experience, which there isn't much that gets an 11 out of 10 out of a teenager. Catherine, you think we need a minister for toilets in Australia? Seriously?
I do. One of the challenges with public toilets is that there's no real clear owner of the toilet. So we have planners for all other types of infrastructure. So we've got transport planners and we've got parks planners, but we don't have public toilet planners. And they can get lost in all the other priorities of government. Also, you know, local governments can be responsible for delivering toilets, but that it's often they don't have clear funding sources for it. So I think if we have a minister for toilet, we're really saying, hey, this is a type of infrastructure we think is really valuable to our public spaces. And then we can allocate clear responsibilities, whether it sits in the health department, whether it sits in infrastructure, just so, you know, we really prioritise them and value them for what they are.
So you went on your research trip in 2018. Since you came back, have you noticed much progress in this space?
I think one of the challenges with our built environment is that it can take a real long time to see change. However, you know, there has been an increase, I think, from about 19,000 to 23,000 toilets on the National Public Toilet Map. Last year, there was a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry into public toilet. And earlier this year, we saw some changes to the National Construction Code around changes to sanitation facilities. So there are policy changes. I think those changes will take longer to be seen in our built environments, which is so important while we keep talking about this topic.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining me today. Catherine Weber is an international toilet enthusiast and social planning practitioner. Her research for the Rodney Warmington Churchill Fellowship in 2018 examined how public toilets are critical to community participation. And thank you for your Dunny shout-outs. Lauren says the Divine Dunny, aka the Cistern Chapel in Marybury, Queensland, is not only a perfect facility, but a tourist destination full of artworks and music. Google it. Jenny says Renmark public toilets, accessible, always clean and filled with light. And Julian in Narrumbunda says the Hundavasa toilet in the Albury Botanical Gardens is fantastic, particularly the colourful grand architecture. Best toilets, another person says, Norway and Iceland. Well, you're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. That is just about it for Life Matters. I have come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land. I'll be back with you again tomorrow, which is Census Day. And I want to know what you tick when it comes to the religion section. If you are an active worshipper, it's probably a no-brainer. But what if you were raised in a religion and it's part of your culture, but it's not exactly your belief system anymore? Nothing like a census to cause you to grapple with your entire outlook on life, the universe and everything. We're going to talk about that tomorrow on Life Matters, plus how to have the money chat in a relationship. I'm Tegan Taylor and I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.